Hello there, ladies and gents. Welcome to Orwellian Optics, a podcast by Alio Capital, where we explore the intersection of macroeconomics, policy, politics, and particularly how they affect your wallet and your personal finances. I'm your host, Joseph Grudante. I'm here with our Chief Investment Officer, AJ Giannone. AJ, introduce yourself.
I'm AJ Giannone, CFA and Chief Investment Officer here at Alio Capital. In each episode, we're going to dive into how macroeconomics and portfolio management are the key drivers of how you take control of your financial future. Chris?
Thanks, AJ. I'm Chris Morgan, Chief Operating Officer here at Alio Capital, and really excited to be bringing the whys of policy to everybody. Why do we make certain policy decisions and how do they impact economics and ultimately financial markets? Excited this morning to talk at first about Harris's policies a little bit, especially around unrealized gains, what that means. What does that mean for the average person? And going forward, what does that mean for productivity and growth? So Joseph, if you want to kind of kick us off and talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think when you look at these policy proposals, unrealized capital gains, well, what is it? Let's first define what it is. So when you own a stock, for example, and you sell it, that's a realized capital gains. But in the time that you own it, as it goes up, it's essentially shadow money, right? It's unrealized. And that's what she's proposing a tax on. But the rhetoric seems to focus on billionaires, right? And everybody says, yeah, tax them more and tax them more. But who does this really impact the most? And Alio Capital, right? We're a startup. And I can say from firsthand experience, this is going to impact startups the most and our ability to employ talent. And AJ, you might want to get a little bit more in depth there as the Chief Investment Officer. I don't want to steal your swag.
No, thanks, guys. The key thing to remember here that Joseph brought up is the difference between realized and unrealized gains. And, you know, if you look at Harris's proposal, it specifically is targeted at that higher end, that 100 million plus range. But that's really where it starts, where tax proposals did not end up drifting down to capture larger and larger segments of the electorate over time. You look specifically at the income tax that was enacted in the early 20th century as a prime example. And what we're looking at here in her proposal to target unrealized gains is unique in that it targets a source of wealth that isn't liquid. And by liquid, we mean in cash, treasury to pay a tax bill. So, you know, if you sell a stock, like Joseph said, and you made a gain, great, you have cash now. You sold your stock, you realized a profit, you hand some of that profit over to the IRS to pay the treasury your tax bill. In a situation where you receive a tax bill for an unrealized stock position, whether that's the equity in a startup that you work at, or whether that's a stock in your brokerage account, you now have to come up with cash out of pocket to pay for a tax bill that you don't have. So, you know, you either have to go sell something else, which is going to be called a depressive economic activity, or more likely, you have to go to a bank and borrow the money to pay those taxes. Now, it doesn't take a genius to connect A to B and realize that, you know, the billionaire corporate donors backing the Harris campaign are, in a lot of cases, the Wall Street banks. So when you look at the practical repercussions of a unrealized capital gains tax, and you figure out that the most likely outcome from this proposal getting enacted would be a massive windfall to the bank's ability to lend against illiquid, highly unrealized stock positions, it doesn't take a genius to figure out where that idea came from and why it's being proposed. So, Joseph, what do you think about that?
Yeah, we mentioned last time regulatory capture and how the big players, the multinationals, use this to eliminate competition. You can go back to Dodd-Frank, right? And so the idea was to break up the big banks, and yet it led six banks consolidated into five banks. And so it helped consolidate power. And I mean, this is one of the most absurd proposals. I'm wearing a Ross Perot shirt right now. I went to my first political rally when I was 9, 10 years old. And I've never heard such absurdity, because it's not even just, number one, startups, right? And which is one of the only sources of upward mobility right now in the American economy, particularly for young people. You know, you join a startup, you get stock in that company, it becomes successful. Well, now you have the ability to go buy a house or provide for your family because you have ownership in something. And a lot of people out there, they don't have the money to start something. So getting stock and ownership in a company is one of the key paths to upward mobility. But furthermore, small businesses, I mean, an electrician that, let's say, has four or five trucks. I think I read somewhere that each truck, you know, would be worth about $300,000. So they would be impacted by this. And now all of a sudden they got to find money, pay this unrealized capital gain, and they're going to have to lay off some of the guys they have working for them because they need that extra cash to pay the government because it's tied up, right? And so you think of, say, a river and all the streams that come from that river, that's really the dam that it creates in our economy. And well, why do they want to do that? Well, because I think it goes back to who's really funding this campaign and who controls it. And if you look at the fact that the Democrats, as we talked about, they outrage Republicans 3 or 4 to 1. Well, there's a lot of globalist banker interests tied into this. And they want to reduce American sovereignty. I think there's a lot of chatter about the WEF and the World Economic Forum and what their agenda is. But The Hill, I think, is a really great source for objective, you know, independent information. And I just want to play this clip real quick.
This article that was reportedly on the website in 2016 and has since been deleted says, "Welcome to 2030. I own nothing, have no privacy, and life has never been better." I wanted to talk about this because, so this is getting the kind of mainstream media spin of, oh, look at all these people criticizing Davos and the World Economic Forum. They're spreading misinformation and conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. If you're upset about this, you are yourself a conspiracy theorist. It's all just conspiracies. Some of the things they talk about in terms of environmentalism, in terms of state surveillance, state capacity, the kinds of governments run by these very people, what they'll be able to do to you, the kind of social credit score system, tracking, kind of nudging. It's for your health. It's for your own good.
So I want to talk about that because you just heard what he had to say and what parts of it are real. And I think when you look at some of these protests that we've had over the past couple of years, and then you see them wearing masks, the ultimate symbol of authoritarianism coming from where? CDC to WHO. Well, who influences that? Who controls it? Well, the World Economic Forum, right? A lot of the actors and players that are involved in that, certainly, you know, part of the WHO and the CDC, but it's for the first time in American history, you see young people advocating to have their rights taken away, and they don't know that. And so what is this leading to? Well, you just saw it on the screen. In 2030, you will own nothing. There will be social credit scores. You will have no privacy. And most importantly, you're not going to have any upward mobility, which is why you can't own anything. And so breaking American sovereignty and breaking our economy, right, is how they get their proposed goal here, how they get the outcome that they want, because the U.S. Constitution really conflicts with everything that they're trying to accomplish. And I feel like the victim in all this has been Gen Z. And I think it's interesting. Gen Z is the ultimate paradox, because here's this group of, you know, I'll call them kids because I'm dating myself a bit here. I'm an old man now. But, you know, they listen to 80s and 90s music that I grew up with, and they fail to recognize that what made the 80s and 90s so great was individual identity, the lack of groupthink. And what were the policies that produced that culture and where did they come from? Well, you can attribute a lot of it to the Big Gipper, right? Ronald Reagan, even Bill Clinton, right? I mean, both Republicans and Democrats, they worked together on bipartisan legislation, but it was a time of peace and it was a time of, there was no cancel culture, nobody got offended. And as a result, you saw the hip hop movement, the alternative movement, the club scene, all these genres, the goth movement, the punk, you know, the punk scene, all these genres, because everybody, you know, wanted to be, everybody was something different. I remember St. Mark's in downtown New York City in the late 90s, and you know, you'd have skaters, ravers, goth kids, punks, all in one block, because everybody wanted their own individual identity. And so everybody tried to outdo each other and how crazy they could dress up and how many piercings they can get. AJ, what do you think about this?
Well, yeah, I mean, the part of this that I think is particularly troublesome is that the whole thought process behind taking that individualistic American identity and trying to put basically bumpers on it or guardrails and try to say what is approved or what is safe about it and what is maybe potentially dangerous or unsafe. It's just a really terrible paradigm to kind of operate under. What makes America unique is that the founders and the people who arrived here to seize a better life, to give themselves and their families a more hopeful and prosperous future, were understanding of the fact that there is an element of risk and an element of uncertainty that is inherent in that process. There's an element of being uncomfortable, being comfortable being uncomfortable, and being able to acknowledge that fact that as you go through life, if you want to be prosperous, if you want to have freedom, if you want to have all these things that are ideals that we should aspire to, then no one is going to hand them to you. The government certainly is not going to come around with a tray at lunch and just hand you the things that you think you deserve. You have to take ownership on a personal level and execute the strategies that you personally believe will lead you there. And to me, that's the biggest piece that's missing here, is that we've lost an element of that, and I'm not sure how we get it back.
Yeah, we've lost that personal responsibility too, that personal identity. Joseph mentioned St. Mark's. If you go there today, it's all people wearing black shirts and denim jeans. They all look exactly the same, to the point where it's creepy. It almost feels like a post-apocalyptic movie where, you know, we all have these social scores and we don't own anything. We're all just part of this giant system. It's almost scary. It is scary.
Chris, you had some good numbers that I thought you should bring up that kind of allude to this. Can you speak to what you saw in that poll you looked at?
Yeah, we were reading this poll about how many people are proud to be Americans. It compared today to 2003. In 2003, people were polling at about 70% saying they were extremely proud to be an American. Today, that number is right around 41%. That's insane. That's breaking down what it means to be us, to be American. People are no longer proud of that. It's wild.
Yeah, they're breaking our culture. And it's interesting, you know, you look at the term MAGA. They don't even say it because they know. I mean, how could you say the term Make America Great and turn that taboo or say that's provocative and negative? To me, it's tantamount to go into a local supermarket or a farmer's market, I should say, that says buy local, right? You should want your country to be exceptional, right? You should want a great economy. Of course, there are certain things that the government needs to do, and I think ensure equal opportunity, but not equality of outcome, because, you know, you're going to get what you put in. And innovation is what increases our life expectancy. It's what raises our standard of living. And, you know, you have to, for lack of a better expression, kind of unleash the animal spirits to get that innovation. But that rising tide helps everyone. And poor Gen Z, you know, they've been manipulated and lied to. And so they're out there with masks on, literally saying, censor me, take my right to defend myself away, take my pride. And they don't know that they're saying that. And I don't know how to communicate with this generation. Chris, you have thoughts on that?
If you think about what the founders went through to make sure we have these rights and what that generation is now voting against, part of innovation is risk-taking, right? Part of what the government should do is incentivize people to take risk to make things better. We're not just developing along a horizontal, you know, move production overseas. You have to take risks to move vertically and actually make things different and better. And if the government, to tie things back to a policy, if the government is instituting a tax on unrealized capital gains, that is disincentivizing risk, and that is government meddling in business and the economy in a way that it is not supposed to, and in a way that the founders would be turning over in their graves. AJ, do you have anything you want to add?
The key thing there, just to go back to this point real quick, is that from an economics perspective, taxing unrealized capital gains is just disastrous policy. There are other ways to accomplish that goal, if you so choose, that won't have such disastrous impacts. One of the particularly insidious aspects of an unrealized capital gains tax, though, is that because there's no realization event, it's up to either A, the government, or a private transaction at a non-market clearing price to determine what your tax bill is going to be. So you have something like a 409A valuation. Okay, sure, there's a mark on your business. But if, for example, you don't have any kind of capital raising event or anything that would trigger a valuation event, there's effectively a ladder in place that's going to say your business grew this much in value this year. This is the tax bill that you owe. And even more than that, theoretically, there are a multitude of examples where maybe 10 shares trade at a certain price. That's not necessarily indicative of what the entire corpus of that equity stake is going to be worth upon a realization event. So there are a multitude of ways for this to be gamed, which, given the proclivity of people with wealth and means to seek out innovative and perhaps creative ways to structure their wealth, will no doubt be gained. And inevitably, that's going to lead to shortfalls in the assumptions of how much money this is going to bring into the treasury versus what was predicted. And they're going to go after people one rung lower and then a rung further lower, all the way down until, you know, this hits middle class taxpayers like every other piece of this pie. Because unfortunately, that's where the bulk of the wealth is in America, is at the middle class. You can look at billionaires owning a disproportionate percentage of wealth, sure. But if you want to actually fix the budget deficits and the fact that we are spending more than we make, and you go after tax receipts as a way to do that, you inevitably end up at the unfortunate realization that the only place you can get the sum of money required to accomplish that goal is from going after middle-class taxpayers.
1,000%. And I just wanted to tie it back, you know, to why. The why. Why would they do this? Well, what we talked about in the first part, economic freedom is the prerequisite to political freedom. So if they take away your economic freedom, that, right, is the catalyst and impetus for the government to seize more control, right? And so that's why they're doing it. So they can get more control of your life. And the fact that they've manipulated young people to advocate for this is pretty scary. And I want to just talk about the term liberalism. What does it mean to be a liberal? Because I don't really like to use right or left, but for the sake of helping people understand in a colloquial way, the left has kind of co-opted this term. If you look at liberalism throughout the 18th century, the 19th century, right? It was all about fighting against the centralization of power. And you talk about the founders and what makes us Americans, right? We don't capitulate to centralized power, right? We fight back against centralized power. That is what our Constitution is about, these freedoms that we have that many Americans take for granted. But the term liberalism, I think post-World War II, started to be manipulated a little bit, right? Because it has a very positive connotation versus the term, say, conservative. Like, nobody really, conservative, liberalism, progressive, they have positive connotations, but they don't, it's, again, name this podcast as Orwellian Optics, and we want you to be able to see through the fog, and that often left is right and up is down. And so liberalism, as it's being used today, I mean, Kamala Harris talking about democracy and liberalism, I mean, it's mind-blowing. This is a woman that didn't get a single vote to run for president, not even by the Democrat delegates. But the term liberalism, right, a lot of young people, they want to say, oh, I'm a liberal, right? And no, you're not. You are actually advocating for authoritarianism. And when you advocate towards socialism, look at history, it is a path to fascism, right? Mussolini was a huge socialist. And then eventually he came to the conclusion, well, socialism didn't go far enough. And so it leads to the government having more control. And I think the left is not liberal. The paradigm has shifted. And going back to Trump, again, we are an independent company. I want to just really get that point across, is that we're not left or right. We're not about red or blue. We're about the green and helping you to understand how this is going to have an impact in your future, your upward mobility, your posterity, your children's abilities to have a better future. For the first time in American history, young people are more likely to be worse off than their parents were. And that's because of they're being manipulated into policies that are going to hurt them. And so we're trying to help you guys, you know, see through the fog. And going back to the World Economic Forum and this guy, Klaus Schwab, you know, you want to talk about Trump and paint Trump as a villain. Okay, Trump's got a lot of flaws, but society is not black and white. And when you look at people going out to vote, you see people on one side, it's this eclectic group of libertarians, for lack of a better word, conservatives, progressives. That's what a lot of Democrats on the Trump side, they're not, it's not really a movement of Republicans, it's a populist movement. And so it's an anti-establishment movement. So I just want to show this clip real quick of Klaus Schwab, a guy who's worth a lot more than Trump, 20, 30 times what Trump is worth. He's a global banker who wants control of your life. And so listen to what he has to say here in terms of what the biggest threat is to this system of control that they're trying to enact, undemocratically, I might say, right?
If you look what's happening in the United States, particularly, you have this anti-system movement. What we are seeing is a revolution against the system. It's dismantling the system, and we see certain elements of this now in the new U.S. administration.
You heard it for yourselves, and yet, you know, they just use Trump as the zeitgeist, and it's kind of scary because, you know, I don't vote based on, hey, do I want to have a pot roast with one of these people? I look at how their policies are going to impact my life and my ability to be better off than I was a year ago and 2 years before that. And it's kind of scary that a lot of the vote on that side is just anti-Trump vote. It's just based in anger, fear, but it's not policy driven. And, you know, Chris, what do you think about that?
Yeah, it's crazy how I was just thinking about liberals from history. How did that term start and how did it develop? And it was brought around by guys like John Locke and the idea that we needed to shed the monarchy and shed this kind of overarching centralized control. So a guy like Thomas Jefferson considered himself liberal. And what did he want to do? He wanted every individual to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. He wanted them to focus on their life, their neighbor's life, not who's across the world. That guy was a liberal. He wanted the best of individuals in his country and not what's best for the world. So to see it develop into something that it is now, this kind of Klaus Schwabian, everybody's the same, global trade, it's kind of scary. But it makes me think, what will that develop into next? Will we have to go through this burning it all down to rise out of the ashes? AJ, what do you think of that?
No, I mean, I certainly hope not. You know, I think this podcast is a good start in terms of an antidote to the disease, but there are a whole lot of others who are saying the same things, and their voices are being pushed down by traditional corporate media and by really the same monetary and powerful interests that are pushing these really destructive policies on us. And you can go to the reasoning that they have, and it's to your video's point, Joseph. They see the populist movement as a threat to their power. They've worked tirelessly and selfishly to secure vast amounts of wealth and vast amounts of power to protect that wealth. And unfortunately for them, we are all individuals who have agency and we live in a country that is still free and we are free to voice these concerns and highlight these machinations and give rise to dissenting opinions that can hopefully persuade others to see these things for what they are and to vote, which is the single greatest power that we as American citizens have to exercise our right to vote in our interests and not in the interests of the globalist corporate billionaire class who really see no problem with the current situation and would prefer to keep it status quo for as long as possible. And that's a real problem because I think a lot of people are not in a very good spot right now. And to Joseph's point, our goal as citizens should be to leave the country in a better spot for our children than we received it from our parents. And frankly, we're failing at that right now.
Yeah, I mean, the entire goal of this company is to make an impact, a positive impact on society, right? You only get one shot at this thing called life. And if you're not trying to make society better, then what are you doing here? But unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of, as AJ mentioned, vested power interests that want to protect their wealth and their control, and they're not looking out for your best interests. I mean, you know, the acronym ESG, right? Just to use an example. Well, it sounds good, right? Environmental, social, governance, right? These standards they want to put in place. But what is it really about? Who participates in it? Well, it's stakeholder capitalism. It's these multinational corporations that they almost, from the WEF standpoint, the Davos standpoint, they want to give these multinational corporations that participate and go by the rules all the power. And that is against, you know, many times your best interest because, you know, their interests are not your interest. And it's just so scary that they've, you know, been able to manipulate young people by taking control of our institutions, particularly the media and academia, to kind of advocate for what they want and work against their best interest because we've never really witnessed this before in American history. And to tie it all back to what we're really trying to accomplish here at Alio Capital, the election's coming up. And again, Donald Trump, whatever your opinion is, fine. But when you look at people like Tulsi Gabbard and you look at people like Dennis Quaid and Robert Kennedy Jr. and Eric Weinstein and Russell Brand, Tucker Carlson, I understand there's a little stereotype and connotation, but I implore you to actually listen to this man and the work that he's done, one of the last real journalists that we have in this country, trying to get the truth to the people. This is an eclectic group of different individuals with different ideas, but what they all agree on is that there's a major threat to humanity right now. And the way that we kind of fight this second American Revolution, if you will, is with our voices and how we vote. And, you know, it's up to you to make that decision, but we're just here to kind of give you the facts and information as we see it. Chris, AJ, you have any last thoughts?
The one point there, Joseph, is I actually watched an interview with Russell Brand sitting there with Tucker Carlson over the weekend, and he made the point like, oh, you know, they get this guy, RFK Jr., and he comes out with a message that's, I want to make America healthy again. I want to promote free speech and want to protect our children and make sure everybody can live and thrive. And they're like, oh, this guy's a hard right-wing fascist. Like, are you kidding me, man? Like, this can't be real life. Like, this is not something that makes any sense intuitively, but the corporate media has captured the populace so much to the extent that these voices don't get heard and the message gets spun and respun until it's exactly what fits in their little boxes. But I mean, to me, that was just absolutely comical. It takes a guy like Russell Brand to kind of really articulate that in a way that makes it so abundantly obvious that we're getting sold a bill of goods here.
That's the perfect example that the entrenched powers do not care about you, listener. They don't care about Joseph. They don't care about AJ. They don't care about me. They care about themselves and making themselves richer. That's it. So anytime you vote for these people, anytime you support them, that's what you're supporting. And that's what we want to do is change that. We want to expose the, pardon my language, but the bullshit that's out there and be able to help you think more clearly and make more efficient decisions for all of us. That's different, right? Nobody else is doing that. We're not afraid to speak up and tell you what's wrong. Other folks might want to keep things the way they are, but it's in your best interest, it's in our best interest to muddy the waters a little bit and for change, for positive change for humanity.
In that same regard too, an interesting statistic that I saw was that in the wake of the COVID recovery, the number of startups and the number of small business formations are at all-time highs. And these are people who are generally younger, potentially millennials and Gen Z demographics, who've made the decision to start their own business, to go down the path of entrepreneurship. And if we don't, as a country, nurture and support these small businesses and these entrepreneur-minded folks to build the businesses that will be the household names of tomorrow, and we crush them under onerous regulations that were written at the behest of the Walmarts and the Amazons to protect their monopoly status, that's really the primary vector with which people are able to attain that American dream level of wealth and prosperity is through small business formation, is through equity ownership in small business and startup formations and foundation. So from that perspective, I think it's imperative that as we look out here at the election looming, at the future elections, that we keep in mind this is a key part of the American economy. And it's at risk. We have an incredibly resourceful, intelligent, well-educated group of founders and entrepreneurs who are now in the very early stages of this journey. And if we don't help them reach the level that they are capable of, it will be a massive disservice to the future.
It's innovation, right? That's our quality of life. The way we're going to solve a lot of these issues that are facing us, like climate change, is not through government regulation. The government doesn't solve any problems, right? They're there, you know, they can provide some basic services like the police and the firemen, but go to the DMV if you want to understand how the government operates. If that's what you want your healthcare to look like and your economy to look like and your future to look like, well, then you know who to vote for, right? But if you want to have, you know, an opportunity at a better future, well, then you got to look at the other side. If you really call yourself a liberal, I mean, I'm not into ideologies, right? I consider myself to be more of an existentialist and a libertarian. But if you really want to break it down on a simple level, what do the Democrats stand for? Big government. That's what that party stands for from an ideological perspective. You know, the GOP, I think people tend to associate the GOP with Dick Cheney and George W. Bush, but these were neocons, you know, John McCain's pro-military industrial complex. If you look at the history of the Republican Party, Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Booker T. Washington, you know, Frederick Douglass, Dwight Eisenhower. Well, it's about limited government, right? Because there's only two systems. It's either the government has control of everything, or you have the government and the private sector, and the private sector acts as a check on government. And no, it's not perfect, but it's certainly preferred to the former in terms of when you look at the results and upward mobility. I mean, you know, historically, socialism has produced more poverty and destruction than any other system in history, and capitalism has lifted more people out of poverty. Now, there has to be some balance, and I believe in social safety nets, and, you know, there are certain policies that should be socialistic, but even then, I think it's probably best pursued through a public-private partnership. And so, again, you know, at Allio Capital here, we're trying to cut through the noise. And we are an investment company, folks, right? We focus on absolute returns and we position our portfolios for geopolitical risk, right? Because there is all this change happening on a global stage. You can't just hide out in fixed income anymore and get the diversification you need. and you don't know how things are going to go. The election right now is too close to call. And so your assets have to be positioned for that. And so we do the podcast to get people to really look at these policies and how they impact the macroeconomics. Because, you know, the two things that really affect markets the most are monetary and fiscal policy. That's what determines growth. That's what determines inflation. That's what determines the credit spread and the risk premium. And so often people, they don't want to talk about politics, but they'll talk about economics and they don't understand how the two are correlated. And so that's why we do what we do every week on the show. And with that, folks, that wraps up this episode of Orwellian Optics. We hope you found the discussion insightful. Don't forget to check us out at alleocapital.com. You could sign up and join our beta list. And don't forget to check us out on Apple Podcasts, YouTube Music, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you again for joining us. Peace and love. See you next time.
Thanks, everybody.